March 22nd, 2015, in Laguna Beach, California. And we'll be reading from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 6, which is on Jnana Yoga, also sometimes known as Astanga Yoga, text 10. Many of you have Bhagavad Gita. In Sanskrit, is yogi yun jita satatam atmanam rahasi stita ekati yata chittatma nirashir aparigraha. And the word that we're going to be focusing on today is the last one here, aparigraha. So we're going to read Srila Prabhupada's word by word translation. Yogi is a transcendentalist. Yunjita means must concentrate in Krishna consciousness. Satatam means constantly. Atmanam means himself, by body, mind, and self. Rahasi means in a secluded place. Stita means being situated. Ekaki means alone. Yata chitta atma. Always careful in mind. Every word here is so wonderful. Nirashihi, without being attracted by anything else. And Srila Prabhupada translates, aparigraha, as free from feeling of possessiveness. Okay, if we look at this word, aparigraha. So anyone know what pari means? Pada, pari. We often talk about pada, param, atma.
Supreme.
Supreme. Anything else? Any other meanings of param?
In the sense of greater.
Greater, okay, or other. So, supreme, greater, or other. And a, the prefix a in Sanskrit, anyone know what that means? Yes?
The antonym opposite.
Opposite, okay. And graha means to grab. So, a pari graha means don't grab others. So, Srila Prabhupada's translation. A transcendentalist should always engage his body, mind, and self in relationship with the Supreme. He should live alone in a secluded place and should always carefully control his mind. He should be free from desires and feelings of possessiveness. We're going to just read the last paragraph of this purport. Actually, no, we'll do the last two paragraphs. When one is not attached to anything, but at the same time accepts everything in relation to Krishna, one is rightly situated above possessiveness. On the other hand, one who rejects everything without knowledge of its relationship to Krishna is not as complete in his renunciation. That's from Bhaktivedanta Sindhu 1 to 256. A Krishna conscious person well knows that everything belongs to Krishna, and thus he is always free from feelings of personal possession. As such, he has no hankering for anything on his own personal account. He knows how to accept things in favor of Krishna consciousness and how to reject things unfavorable to Krishna consciousness. He is always aloof from material things because he is always transcendental. And he is always alone, having nothing to do with persons not in Krishna consciousness. Therefore, a person in Krishna consciousness is the perfect yogi. So here Krishna is giving that one of the qualities to be situated in yoga, to be situated in yoga doesn't mean just that you can hold a certain asana, but it means to be an enlightened being, somebody who is self-realized, who is God-realized, who is situated in the truth. And this aparigraha refers to both the means and the goal. In other words, if you are an enlightened being, you are an aparigraha. And if you want to be an enlightened being, you need to practice aparigraha. Okay, does that make sense? Not taking what belongs to others. We could also say this is means being satisfied with your own quota. And here Prabhupada is saying, being free of possessiveness. Not saying, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine. And this, of course, reminds us of another verse in the Isha Upanishad, Mantra 1, Ishyavasyam Idam Sarvam, that the Lord has given everyone their quota, and one should be satisfied with one has, not hankering for anything else. And Prabhupada, in the purport to that verse, says, the root of sin is deliberate disobedience to the laws of nature through disregarding the proprietorship of the Lord, that everything belongs to Krishna. If we examine practically any of the social problems in the world today, we will see that they all have this root in this parigraha, encroaching on something that is not yours. And this tendency is there in us at an individual level. And you see the two children, they're fighting over who has the marble, you know, who has the lollipop, or who gets to sit in what seat. Right? Each child wants to sit in the same seat, and they're biting and scratching and kicking and screaming. You've seen this? Little children? Right? And nations do this, except the nations don't just bite and scratch and kick and scream. They get out their guns. That's my seat. No, that's my seat. And they go to war over, literally, a piece of dirt. Pretty silly, isn't it, when you think about it? Right? It's my piece of dirt. No, it's my piece of dirt. No, it's my piece of dirt. I want your piece of dirt because there's gold under it. You know, and this is all of the wars. How many wars are going on now? 40 wars going on at any one time in the world. And it's all this parigraha, wanting something that's not mine, wanting something that's not given to me, or because someone else has done that to me. What do they say? The cost of one fighter jet could cure all the homelessness in America? You know, Srila Prabhupada, our spiritual master, the founder of the Hare Krishna movement, he would often say that there's plenty in the world for everyone. It's just a question of greediness. I'm sure you all know how much food we throw away in this country. Do you know that in most of the world, we Americans are not very much liked? So I spend most of my time out of America. I travel around the world at least once a year. And we're not looked upon very favorably because they say, well, you're only 5% of the population using 50% of the world's resources. This is, again, parigraha. We're taking something that's not ours. And I was just listening the other day to a recorded lecture. Srila Prabhupada was complaining about how he was harassed at immigration in the United States. And he said, you Americans, you took the land from the Red Indians. It wasn't yours. And now you're standing at the border saying no one else can come in. This is parigraha. This is mine. I'm taking something that's not mine and saying that it's mine. And you think of, right, how much of the opulence that we have in our life is because somebody somewhere is working without medical insurance at substandard wages, right? Breathing in terrible chemicals. We're thinking, oh, wow, I got a bargain for only $5. Or what about a lot of the food that we eat? Are we trying to force the earth to produce in ways that she's not really designed to? We're pouring our chemicals into the earth, or what to speak of those who are eating meat. Now, first of all, just eating meat is parigraha. Meat is not the natural diet for a human body. Taking something that's not mine, and then how the animals are suffering. But even those of us who are vegetarian, the earth is so much suffering. We're pouring all these pesticides and chemicals and fertilizers and herbicides into the earth to try to force the earth to produce the way that we want it, so that we can have the same food all year, you know? So you can have strawberries in January. And mangoes in September. And you can just have them all year. Taking something that's not ours. Trying to force something that's not ours. And really all of our suffering on a global level and on an individual level comes from this tendency to take something that's not ours. And if we can't get it by negotiation, we try to get it by force. And practically, our modern society is based on the concept of trying to force. We're trying to force our body to behave in ways it's not intended to behave. This is, of course, is the basis of almost all intoxicants. Right? Why do people drink coffee? They're trying to force their body to have energy that it doesn't naturally have. This is the basis, I said, of almost all of our food. Trying to force our body to digest something it's not meant to digest, to force the earth to produce something it's not meant to produce. And our whole economy, I mean, I'm sorry to say this, but you know, most of the things that we're enjoying are at the expense of somebody else. And this causes a reaction. All of the universe is meant to be in balance and meant to be in harmony. And when we get things out of harmony by forcing and by taking, and then there's a reaction. There's reaction of disease, there's reaction of drought, there's reaction of famine and war, and so many things. And really, all of our own individual suffering, whatever we're going through in our life with other people, with nature, with our own body, with our own mind, is due to this parigraha. Therefore, Krishna says, parigraha. Now, of course, you can say, well, why can't we deal with this? You know, we're trying. It's not that we in the Hare Krishna movement are the only ones. Maybe someone could close that door because the sun is totally blinding me there. We in the Hare Krishna movement are not the only ones who say that we should live in balance and harmony. In fact, it's becoming more and more of a concept in the world today. When I was a teenager, I remember being in a protest march in favor of the environment. And that was a very radical approach when I was 15. It was considered you were antisocial if you were in favor of the environment. That sounds really strange today, doesn't it? But it was really like that. I mean, I used to watch a TV show of people exploring outer space and the computer synthesized food. And we thought that was great. You know, no more agriculture, just synthesized food, just eat a little pill and you're... So the idea of being in harmony with the environment was a very strange one. So many people are saying that, yes, we should restore balance and we should only take what belongs to us. But we haven't been very successful at that, have we? The fighting is still going on between, you know, 2-year-old and 4-year-old brothers at the park over the frisbee, and the fighting is still going on over pieces of dirt. So we try to settle this by trying to teach people, be satisfied with your quota. Just be satisfied. Srila Prabhupada likes this saying, simple living, high thinking. So we like to tell people, be satisfied with simple living. Reuse, reduce, recycle. You read about some families that don't produce any trash. Did you know? Some families, they produce like one glass jar of trash per year for 5 people. But how many people are doing that? Does that really change anything? Just be satisfied. Just be satisfied. Does it work? If someone says, just be satisfied, does that mean you don't buy the new phone when your phone still works? Because the new phone has some new features? Do you end up being satisfied? Or we say, just be satisfied with what you earn by honest labor. Does that work? Do people only do honest labor? No, they don't. People try to find a way, you know, somehow or other, to work fewer hours and get paid more. Or do investments that are really not investments, they're really gambling. Right? Or some way to cheat, to get something more than what we're due. And we can even try to define, okay, well, what's our quota? What is my due? And get very legalistic about it. Or we could pass laws. Right? There are some countries in the world that try to balance everything through laws, especially the Scandinavian countries do this. Right? They heavily tax the rich and redistribute the wealth, to try to have no rich people and no poor people. And they tried to solve this parigraha problem in that way. Does that work? Do you think everybody in the world would accept this? Would we accept this here in America?
No.
We don't even want socialized medicine. We say that's only for the rest of the democratic societies, not for us. So trying to do it by laws doesn't work. Try to do it just by preaching to people. You should be honest, you should just accept only what you need, live a balanced life. It doesn't work. Now, why doesn't it work? This is the question. I mean, it seems like it should work. People should want to be healthy and want there not to be wars, and right? That should be enough motivation for people. If I lived a balanced life, I'd be... So why doesn't it work? And this is explained a little later in the Bhagavad Gita, the 7th chapter, Ichudvesha, that we're overcome by desires and envy. Or also the 16th chapter, where Krishna says, Kama krodha tathas lobhas tasmade tvat bhayam tajat. Kama krodha tathas lobhas. lust, anger, and greed. And of the three, lust, anger, and greed, the worst is greed. If you're angry, you yell at somebody, you pound your fist on the table, and then your anger is dissipated. You know, lust can be dissipated, but greed is never dissipated. You never get enough. They say that pretty much everybody wants 10% more money than they have, no matter how much money they have. So you get more, and then you want another 10% more. Right? And this is parikriha, is you're always wanting something more. Something better, something more, something different, something bigger and better and more and different. And not balance. So to understand the solution, we really have to go a little bit further on in the Bhagavad Gita and look. In chapter 14, Krishna describes something amazing, which he says in the beginning of that chapter. He says, this is the best knowledge that I've given you so far. And it's about the modes of material nature, which are then described in detail in chapter 17 and 18. And by the way, I really suggest that if you haven't already picked up your own copy of the Bhagavad Gita, that you do so. It's just an amazing book. When I first read the Bhagavad Gita, I was 17, I was in college, and I just went, wow, with every turn of the page. Seriously, really. Unfortunately, I didn't go to a lot of classes during the couple of days I was reading the Bhagavad Gita, because I didn't want to put it down. So Krishna there explains the modes of material nature, and he explains there's goodness, passion, and ignorance. And he suggests that one transcends all of those and come to the platform of enlightenment. So the problem is that just trying to convince people that they should have values of being satisfied, just trying to convince people that they're going to suffer if they take something that's not destined for them, and just passing laws doesn't work, because it's all within these modes of material nature. When a person's in the mode of ignorance, called tama guna, guna means a mode or a rope, tama means ignorance, they're overwhelmed by lust and anger and greed, and all they think about are fulfilling their own needs and desires as quickly as possible in the most efficient way for them, regardless of the cost. This is the mode of ignorance. It's the mode of ignorance that causes people to eat animals and causes people to feed the animals hormones and antibiotics so that they get fat in just 10 days and they can't even stand and they fall over and then they kill. That's very much the mode of ignorance. But the mode of ignorance is also, you know, I'm just going to go to work, do my job, get my money, sit home, watch the television, and go to sleep, drink some beer and have sex, go to sleep. That's very much the mode of ignorance. And we have to say, frankly, that in most of the world, this mode of ignorance is very, very dominant. It's how do I get something immediately for myself with as little payment as possible? In fact, if I can steal it, that's even better. And I just don't worry about any consequence because, you know, there's really no purpose to the world anyway. The whole world is just some sort of accident. There was just some sort of big bang and nothing became something, and then there were just planets out of nowhere, and then, you know, some soup just became alive and then it sort of mutated, and then there were giraffes and palm trees and gorillas and elephants. And it's all just chance. It's all just billions and billions and billions of mutations, and there's no brain and there's no soul and there's no real, there's nothing really that we call life. All we are machines. We're just very fancy, complicated machines that somehow became conscious. There's no purpose to anything. There's no life to anything. Survival is to the fittest. And if everything fell apart, it wouldn't matter anyway, because it's just a useless machine. So this is very, very much this mode of ignorance. And as long as a person is in the mode of ignorance, they're never going to care about balance and harmony, and they're never going to care about not encroaching on others. Because to them, the law of the universe is survival of the fittest. The law of the universe to them is I'm supposed to encroach on others. I'm supposed to take. Might is right. If I'm bigger and stronger than you, I can just take. And there's no law. There's no law governing anything. There's no plan. There's no, what to speak of love. There's no meaning to emotion. Emotion is just some chemical in the brain, and it has nothing, no value. So when people are in the mode of ignorance, there's no kind of convincing that one can do this. And if you pass laws, they'll try to find a way to get over and under the law. Then there's the mode of passion. The mode of passion is also not interest in balance and harmony. The mode of passion is interested, people in the mode of passion are interested in doing the right thing, but they're interested in doing the right thing so they can get more for themselves legally. They still want to encroach on others. They still want to get more for themselves, but they want to do it in the proper way. And they want to do it mostly for pride and honor, so they can have their statue up in the park and their name in the history book. Whenever we find ourselves doing something because we want to impress others, this is the mode of passion. Whenever we come disturbed that others don't notice what we've done, that we don't get credit for what we've done, that we don't get acknowledgement for what we've done, this is very much the mode of passion. The mode of passion is all about bigger and better and more and bigger and better and more and bigger and better and more. It's very external. Although the person in the mode of passion wants to do the right thing, they want to do the right thing for the wrong reasons. So both the person in ignorance and the person in passion is concerned about their gratification. The person in ignorance wants it immediately at any cost. The person in passion may work hard for it, but it's still about them, and it's still about externals, and it's still about taking for themselves. And the population on the earth that's not in ignorance is generally in passion. And it's this mode of passion which, again, we have to say, is generally what's preached as religion in the world. So most of the religions in the world, whether they're Christian or Hindu or Jewish or Islam or Buddhist even, most of what they're teaching is this mode of passion. Be a good person. Be a good person. You know, have to get married, have children, have an honest livelihood, pay your taxes, give some charity, worship God, and you'll get a reward. You'll go to heaven. You'll be prosperous in this life, and you'll go to heaven. And that's the purpose of religion. And most religions are teaching this, and most of the governments and different organizations that are teaching values are very much teaching them in this mode of passion. When they're saying, be honest, be considerate, be helpful, be thoughtful. Why? So other people will have high regard for you, and so that you can get more and bigger and better in a legitimate way. So that you can be the master of nature, that you can be the master of the earth, that you can be dominant over nature, dominant over the creatures of the world, that you can be the king of the mountains. This is very, very much in the mode of passion. You can have great prosperity. So again, if you're going to be teaching don't encroach upon others to people in the mode of passion, they're going to understand this in a very legalistic way. They're going to say, well, as long as I follow, you know, the rules of the government, and as long as I follow the rules of the society, you know, then I can take as much as I want. So as long as it's legitimate that the things I buy are causing pain to others, as long as that's sanctioned by my society, it's okay. So then there are some people in the world today in the mode of goodness called sattva-gun. And this you don't find very often. Unfortunately, the world today is mostly in passion and ignorance. But this sattva-gun is quite different. In sattva-gun, people are motivated not in externals, but in internals. The people in sattva-gun are looking for internal balance and internal harmony. They want to do the right thing because it feels so good to do the right thing. The person in ignorance, they don't care about the right or wrong thing. They just want to get what they want to get. The person in passion, they want to do the right thing so they can enjoy the world externally and be praised. The person in goodness wants to do the right thing just because it feels good. So the person in goodness wants to be forgiving and charitable and honest because when you're in goodness, you experience a sense of inner happiness. You experience a sense of inner peace and inner contentment. Of course, goodness is also not enlightenment, because also in goodness, not only do you experience some inner peace and inner contentment and inner balance, but you also feel some inner superiority. You have this sense of, I'm really peaceful and I'm really balanced. Unlike those people looking for the bigger and the better. Certainly, most of the religions in the world teach something about this goodness. Something about this goodness. Wanting to be good for the sake of being good. But then we find it has the side of self-righteousness to it, doesn't it? Which sort of muddies the whole thing. Now, also one's motivation and goodness can be for salvation, for liberation. That I'm going to be good, and that way I'll get my own personal enlightenment for me. I'll become an enlightened being. So even at that level, my dear friends, there is an element of this greed. There is an element of this greed. I want for me. Even though a person in goodness is saying, I want balance and I want harmony. Why do I want balance and I want harmony? For me. Because it feels so good for me. So the problem is that when one is in ignorance, one doesn't care about balance and harmony at all. One only cares about me immediately. When one's in passion, one may care about balance and harmony to impress others. One doesn't care about it on a deep level. And even in goodness, one is still caring about me. Now, as long as I'm caring mostly about me, even if it's in goodness, and my dear friends, goodness is very, very rarely taught or practiced in the world. You say most of the religious systems in the world are teaching compassion. Be a good person, follow the laws, and God will give you a reward. But as long as someone is in this me consciousness, that it's all about me, one cannot be free of this panikana, wanting to take something that is not mine. Because if it's all about me, well then, why shouldn't I take for me? I am the center. So in order to solve this problem, we have to get at what is the real root. And the real root is wanting. And this seems very inconceivable, okay? This is, I think, the only inconceivable thing that we really have in our Hare Krishna philosophy. I mean, okay, we have some other inconceivable things in that the Bhagavatam talks about life on other planets and describes in detail what kind of creatures live on other planets. Some of them horrible and some of them wonderful and celestial, and describes things like big birds that can fly from one planet to another. And there's instances of these being seen by astronauts, by the way. But anyway, we have that kind of inconceivable thing in our teaching. But I think most people can kind of get a handle on that. But this one inconceivable thing seems to be the one thing that people who come to the Hare Krishna movement say, I don't know if I can accept that. And that is that the root of this problem is that we are choosing. And I'm really putting this in the present tense, for those of you who know grammar, present, perfect, are choosing. We are choosing to be an illusion of separateness from the whole. We are choosing to be an illusion of separateness from the whole. We are choosing, it's called Bahir Mukhe. Bahir means outside, Mukhe means face. We're choosing to turn our face from truth. We are choosing to be an illusion. And the reason that people find this so hard to accept is that people just say, well, why would I choose something that is so harmful to myself? Now, it's interesting that we find this inconceivable and ask this question when every day all around us people choose to do things that are harmful to themselves knowingly. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Yes? I hope I'm not offending any of you by this, but, you know, is there any logical reason to smoke cigarettes? Those of you who smoke, I'm sorry. But is it a logical, rational choice? No. And everybody knows, I mean, when I was a little girl, it wasn't known. But at least now everybody knows that cigarette smoking is harmful. And now it's even, you know, you become a social outcast practically. You think that with no smoking in public places and no smoking in the workplace, and right, you have to go outside. Of course, here you never have cold and rain, but other people in other parts of the country have to stand out in the cold and the rain to smoke. You'd think that that would be enough. But still people smoke. And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but if we can think for a minute, did I do something today that I know isn't good for me and still I voluntarily did it? Do I do things voluntarily, knowingly, that are not good for me? Do I choose to think, to watch, to hear, to say, to eat, to go places, to be with people that I know are not good for me? And I know that I will regret. I know it in advance. I've already had experience. And still, I do it. So why is it so inconceivable that we could be choosing the great big thing and choosing to be in illusion? By the way, what's the benefit of choosing to be in illusion? There has to be some, at least perceived benefit. The benefit of choosing to be in illusion is you get to think that you're the center of the universe. Which is obviously, logically, not true. Is it true? Anybody here actually, literally, the center of the universe? Not only am I not the center of the universe, my family isn't the center of the universe. Not only is my family not the center of the universe, but even, you know, Laguna Beach isn't the center of the universe. Not only is Laguna Beach not the center of the universe, even, I'm sorry to inform you, but even America isn't the center of the universe. How about any of us actually believe that? The Earth isn't the center of the universe. Even our solar system isn't the center of the universe. Even our galaxy isn't the center of the universe. And maybe even our universe isn't the center of reality. But when you're in illusion, you get to think everything revolves around me. If it's sunny today, it's because I had a picnic planned. Right? Whatever happens, you know, it's all about me. Everything that happens. You know, which game wins the basketball tournament? It's all about me, because it's my team. And that's what we get. And wanting that, one chooses to be an illusion. But there's a price. The price of being an illusion is we experience ourselves as separate from everybody else. I no longer experience that I'm connected to everybody here. I no longer experience that I'm connected to nature. And I no longer experience I'm connected to God, to Krishna, to my source. In order to have this illusion of being the center of everything and being the most important, I have to have this feeling of being disconnected. Because as soon as I could feel that I was connected, then immediately connected to what? I have to be connected again to the center, the real center, and feel connected to everyone else. And immediately I understand that we're all equal. That everybody is terribly, incredibly important, but nobody is more important than anybody else. That everyone is equally important. So that is the only real solution. Because when we willfully, intentionally turn our face back to reality, then we discover that I already have everything I need. And not only everything I need, but everything I could ever want. And I always have had everything that I need and everything I could ever want. Because I'm connected to the source of everything. All the time. And my feeling of emptiness, which causes me to have envy and jealousy of the possessions of others, or something that I don't have, is only due to this illusion of being separate from my source. And as soon as I see that I'm already connected to my source, I've always been connected. I always will be connected. I'm always connected to the unlimited. Then being satisfied with what I have does not translate into just, well, I have only one old pair of shoes. I have to be satisfied with that. I only have $50 in the bank account. I have to be satisfied with that. That's not what it means. It means that I understand that I, as a spiritual being, am connected to unlimitedly everything. Whatever I would want by having $1 billion, whatever I would want by having 100 shoes, whatever I would want, by whatever I would want, I already have that. I mean, why do people want money? Security, right? Isn't what they call it, right? Securities. You get your investment, they call it securities. People want money for security. We want money for pleasure. We want money for status. Yes? For health. But if you already have security, and you already have status, and you already have health, and you already have pleasure, would you need money? No. So one becomes fully satisfied because one has what one wants by getting everything else. One has what's at the root of it. One has peace. One has fun. One has autonomy. One has excitement. One has security. One has everything because we already have it all, actually. It's not something to be gained from another source. And everybody has an unlimited supply because we're all connected with the unlimited source. Therefore, what is the question of encroaching on somebody else's anything? It doesn't even make any sense anymore. It becomes a very peculiar concept. Trying to force something, or trying to be exploitive, or trying to just want more and bigger. If I already have unlimitedly big of everything, because I'm connected with the unlimited source. Then you may say, well, wait a minute, but if I haven't yet realized that, how am I going to behave? Do I just sort of pretend that I've realized it? Because we talked about in the beginning that this is both the means and the end. That when one is awakened to truth, when one sees the truth, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, like the sun lights up everything, then one sees that. I already have everything for which I'm trying to get everything else. The purpose. I already have everything that is the purpose for which I try to get everything else. The purpose for which I try to get a piece of land or a house or a car or a friend. So then, of course, I'm going to be self-satisfied. But here in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is talking about this as a method for becoming enlightened. He's not only talking about it as the evidence that one is already enlightened, but part of the method of becoming enlightened. So that is what we're doing in our Hare Krishna movement. Everything we're doing, we're chanting this Hare Krishna mantra, as you see there on that in that frame. So we're chanting it, of course, with musical instruments, and we're chanting as a meditation on beads. We're taking our vegetarian food and we're offering it to Krishna. We're trying to offer everything in our life to Krishna. As Krishna says, Yakti Rishi Yadignasi Yakti Horsi Tatsya. Yakti Pastasi Kanteya Taku Shram Yakti. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer and give away, do this as an offering unto me. And all of this is with the idea of remembering, I am already connected to the source. That is where my satisfaction lies. In remembering that connection and acting according to that connection. What we're trying to do here, what our practice of bhakti yoga is we're trying to act as if we had already realized the truth. We're trying to act according to reality instead of according to illusion, even when we can't fully perceive reality. It's something like if you were blindfolded and you couldn't see the way, but somebody could direct you. Or, for example, I don't live here in Southern California. I come and visit my son here periodically. And when I drive around, I have to use a GPS because I don't know my way very well. So I don't know the way, but I'm trusting that this little gizmo turn right now. So I'm driving as if I know the way, yes? I'm driving as if I know the way because I'm getting guidance, hopefully, from somebody who knows the way. So that is our process. I may still be blinded by illusion, but I act as if I was already an enlightened being under the guidance of an enlightened being who can say, if you were an enlightened being, you would do this now. Okay. And then what happens is when you do that, the fog starts to clear. Just like when I act according to the map, the GPS, I start approaching my destination. Right? And because I've been here many times before, as I'm driving, I recognize it. Oh yeah, I recognize that. Well, those are those sculptures on that place on the right, and there's the ocean, and there's this hill, and because our natural state is to be enlightened as we copy the behavior of an enlightened being under the direction of an enlightened being, we start waking up to our original state. And we start having things which in the Judeo-Christian tradition are called epiphanies. And we in the Hare Krishna movement like to call realizations. One starts going, oh! Because you start waking up to one's natural state. Oh, yes. They said it was like that, and I'm doing it, and I'm experiencing it, that it's actually like that. And as one gets closer and closer and closer to one's original state, then one wakes up more and more. Of course, what's nice about our original state of enlightenment is that it's not static. It's ecstatic. It's dynamic. It's dynamic. It's not that one reaches a state of perfection and then, okay, now I'm a perfection. Been there, seen that, done that, now what? But perfection is always, as being unlimited, it's something that's constantly expanding and constantly unfolding. It is something that's getting bigger and better and bigger and better. And when you have that bigger and better, you don't try to get bigger and better and bigger and better in the worldly sense, which will always involve encroaching on something that's not ours and upsetting the balance of the universe. So, questions, comments? We have 10 minutes. Yes? Oh, you're most welcome. That is all Srila Prabhupada's grace.
I also want to comment on the fact that I really agree with this, that it's under our own choice that we choose to make decisions which sort of make us turn away from the source. But at the same time, you really tied it up nicely that, yes, it's under the appropriate and accurate guidance we can make advancement. And
yes.
We can make improvement in our lives. And it's an evolving process, and you can, in small measures, start to experience the pleasure.
Absolutely, and you can in big measures too, although most of us like to take small steps because we're not so confident. But you can do it in big measures too. There's actually nothing that's forcing it to be small steps, except us. Thank you. That was very nice. Anybody else? Any comments or questions? Yes.
Hare Krishna Mataji, thank you so much for your lecture. I did get a lot out of it too. When you were first talking, it reminded me of the verse in the Bhagavad Gita that talked about sense restraint and how we can't just restrain our senses unless we have a higher taste.
Yes, harm just from the verse. That is, it's simply not possible. We're not going to fix the world and we're not going to fix ourselves without going back to this source. It's just not going to happen. I mean, we can keep trying with laws and, as Prabhupada would say, planning commissions or just preaching to people. I mean, it can help a little in some ways, but it doesn't really solve the problem. And it finally solves the problem in one way and creates another problem on the other side. Yes?
Thank you so much. Sometimes when I hear about this ideal of being completely satisfied and not, you know, hankering for more and just being satisfied with where you're at, especially in my life right now, it's difficult for me. It creates conflict because, especially entering into householder life or, you know, getting married, and then you can assess your situation and say, well, you know, what's the problem? We don't need to advance materially at all. We can just stay how we are. We have a roof, we have this, we have that. Fine. But how do you keep a balance, or how could you even? It seems contradictory almost to marriage life.
And this is such a nice question. I would really like to suggest you read the book Bhakti Loka by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, because there he goes through, because this verse is very related to what he talks about there. He's looking at the verses in the Nectar of Instruction, which talk about what are the six things that hinder and help devotional service. And of course, one of them is over-collecting, is getting more than what you need. And he talks about how that applies to people who are renounced and how that applies to people who are in family life. But the main thing is this inner satisfaction from being connected with Krishna. And it's really nice. I was listening to a lecture Srila Prabhupada gave the other day, and he said, you cannot give up your desire to possess things in the world unless you have a desire to possess Krishna. That when you have Krishna as your possession, then you're not so interested in other possessions. And just to be very frank, a lot of what people think they need, they really don't need. even if you have children and you have a home and you have a car, you really, probably really don't need as much as you think. You know, so I have 3 grown children and 13 grandchildren now. I just tell you, you know, when we were raising our children, we lived very, very simply. That's not to say you can't have fancy furniture or whatever, but, you know, it's, most of us can really, you know, at this point, I travel the world with one little suitcase. And doing that, if anything you get and have to give away something else, you know, when everything you have is in 22 by 14 by 9, and you learn that you just don't need as much as you think you need. People will say to me, well, you must just travel to warm climates. And I said, no, I have a winter coat, and I have wool socks and wool hats. And you really, a lot of what we think, I need this, I need that, I need this, is just not accurate. But without having Krishna as your possession, it's very difficult. One really wants to have Krishna's there, you know. The I am mine, there's that famous Beatles song, you're probably too young, but they had this song, I mean me mine. So we're not saying get rid of the I mean mine, but I am Krishna's and Krishna is mine. Focus on that. And then it becomes very natural and very easy. It doesn't become again, it's not repression. We're not interested in repression and artificiality and force. Those are all the antithesis of spiritual. Prabhupada said enthusiastic, individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. Focus on I am Krishna's and Krishna is mine. It can also help to have some little mantras. I mean, if you like the Sanskrit, then Krishna says in 245, Nir Yoga Kshema Atmavan, where he says, don't worry about gain and sake, you'll be satisfied in the self. And then I think it's 922, this yoga kshema bahamyaham, that I will take care of everything you have and everything you lack. So if you like Sanskrit, you can have those as your mantra. Nir yoga kshema atmavan and yoga kshema bahamyaham. And if Sanskrit doesn't make it for you, then you can just say, you know, Krishna's providing everything I need all. Krishna's fulfilling all of my needs. Or you could, you know, you make up your own little mantra based on the Sanskrit verses. I am always connected with the infinite. I'm always connected with the infinite. And all of my needs are always provided. All of the reasons for which I want to get things in the world, I actually already have them. And I find that's very helpful. When things don't go right, which they often don't go right yet. Everything that I need is already there. Krishna is already meeting all of my needs in his own way. I'm an eternal being who already has all of my needs. So you can give yourself some little mantra. Anybody else? We have 2 minutes. Yes. Yes.
We have to go up to their house, you know, sometimes, and it's difficult for me because they just sit there sometimes with just the TV on, and I can't stand the television, and it, you know, it's hard to not be judgmental and say, oh, you know, these people are in ignorance, you know, but how do you try to...
Well, instead of being judgmental, you can be compassionate, and what I find is that those situations make me very, very grateful that I have... that I've received some spiritual knowledge from Srila Prabhupada. It makes me very grateful. And generally those situations renew my own determination to take up the spiritual path. Because you just see that people who are simply under the modes of material nature, they're really puppets of the modes. Krishna says they're forced to act helplessly under the modes of material nature. It's a very unfortunate situation. So you should be filled with compassion. Not that I'm better than they are, but I'm definitely very fortunate. Let me use my fortune for myself. Let me never take it for granted. And let me try to help other people as best that I can. but not to get irritated with them and be judgmental. But when people are simply under the modes of material nature, their existential suffering is very acute. Their inner sense of loneliness and isolation is very strong. And it's driving everything they're doing. Everything is being driven by the sense of feeling isolated and disconnected. And it's really a horrible position to be in. Yes?
Thank you for your good words tonight. Maybe it's one of the more impressive lectures you have heard. I just wanted to know if you could share a little bit about your background and how you evolved into spiritual life.
Oh my! Well, if you really want to read that, you can go to my Facebook page, and I have a note there. You know how, I don't know if you're familiar with Facebook, but you have notes. It's about 3,000 words, and I detail there my journey, how I came to the Hare Krishna movement. And that would be better than trying to explain that in about 5 seconds. Very briefly, I read the Bhagavad Gita. So that's my 2-second explanation. The whole explanation, it's there. And if you want to read more about me, there's an article about me on Wikipedia, which is 90% correct. You can read that there. So I really would suggest, if you don't have a copy of this Bhagavad Gita, it's a great, I don't make a penny off of it. I'm not. But I really would suggest that you pick one up. We do have these available here. They're also, of course, if you read books electronically, you can get them on Amazon as an ebook. You can get most of our books available there as electronic books, and we also sell them here. And I invite you to take part in the kirtan and then the wonderful feast. I do want to apologize. You're helping out with my daughter-in-law's son with a very new grandbaby, and I did promise them that I would be back early tonight. So I do apologize that I won't be staying. But thank you very much, and thank you for all of your...